Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Today, we're going to sort of like try and open the door for a series of shows dealing with teacher activism, participatory research on the part of teachers, and the importance of their ability to be able to do said research. It's going to be maybe kind of all over the place for a while as I'm trying to figure out the best way to lay the foundation for what we're going to be dealing with this month. And I say this month in the sense of every week, every Sunday that we're going to be on air this month, we're going to be dealing with a set of issues that are very complex, multi-layered, but when they come together, very important subject matter that we're going to deal with. If there's an underlying theme here, it will be social justice. And I'll try and explain what social justice is. It's an umbrella concept. When you put the word social in front of justice, it encompasses a lot of specific areas dealing with the issue of injustice and justice. For example, education and social justice, race and social justice, gender social justice, political power social justice, historical issues pertaining to justice or lack of justice, political power and social justice. The adjective that precedes justice is a specific area that is characterized by massive injustice historically, contemporarily, but it's injustice as it pertains to that adjective. But when you use the term social justice, that's an encompassing adjective. It encompasses, or it can encompass, racial, gender, economic, political, religious, and on, cultural, regional, national, global justice issues. So that's where we're going to be heading this month, because education has been from the very start of this country an issue of social justice. You know, from, if you've been around here for a while, from when we started this show, and when those times when we talked about education was not available, formal education was not available to everyone, you know this, in the original colonies. It wasn't available to everyone in Europe and to Africa, wherever. It was available to the rich, the 1%, the 2%, the 3%. So the question of equal access to education is historical. So that it has been around. And in this country, we know from the first settlers here all the way to where we are today that education has been one of the primary areas in which injustice has resided for hundreds of years, impacting different segments of the population at different times, and at some time impacting the entire population and regional areas more so than other areas, so that education and social justice go so hand in hand. And it's one of those areas where people don't want to talk about it. People don't want to talk about injustice, inequality, inequities. They don't want to talk about it as relates to almost any area of life. Particularly, I'm referencing the United States. Europe, other places that I've been, they much more freely want to engage in the various inequities in their own country, and particularly the inequities in the United States, and particularly as it surrounds the notion of race. And race and education go together like what someone said the other day, peanut butter and jelly. They are inseparable over the 400-year-plus history of this country. If you got our promotion that came out very, very late, it didn't come out until last night and today. We normally come out on Thursday night. It was because of me. I could not get my stuff together and title and give some idea what this show was going to be about. After having worked on the subject matter of almost my entire career, I still don't know why I couldn't. I would start and go one direction, develop a show, and end up saying no. Start off another direction and go and develop an hour show, no. And on and on and on. And it wasn't until late last night that I bit the bullet and came up with what we're going to be talking about today as an intro to this month's programming. It is a very, very complex issue, as I mentioned just a moment ago. We're talking about educators. We're talking about teachers as activists and or the lack of their activism and the why of their lack of being activists. And we're talking about the impact of the absence of millions, multi-millions of teachers and their lack of, quote, visible activism. And again, and I always say this for those who've been around for a long time, you know, we've talked about this over the years, that teachers could have, in my argument, could have had such a tremendous impact on preventing the neoliberal elite gaining so much power and control over public education over the last 15 years, had we as individuals and collectively as a group become more engaged, more active in protecting both public education and our profession. We didn't, and to any large numbers, to any considerable extent, and as a result, and I won't say totally as a result of us not being activists, we are where we are today. Now, that could be a very, very touchy subject. Of sure, I'm positive that many teachers will be pissed off because I'm saying and have been saying that our lack of activism, individually, collectively, has contributed to where we are today. So I want to look into that and try and bring about some awareness, some understanding, emotional engagement, and hopefully some desire to get engaged on whatever level you can. So what am I talking about? Teachers, whether you know it or not, well, let me go back, because I was about to say one thing. I think it was the last show, at the very, very end, and I said that the curriculum and pedagogy, it is all political. It is all designed with a purpose, and that purpose, if carried forward or is successful, it's designed to serve the interests of economic, political interest groups that we call the elite now, so that we teach via the curriculum their purpose. We teach via pedagogy their purpose, and we teach to their interest. I ended the show, I think it was last week, on that note. So in a sense, I'm taking up from that point of view that whether you know it or not, whether you thought about it in those terms, we are political via our training. By that I mean, if you went to a teacher prep program, and by our occupation when we get to our school district, our school, and our classroom. We're political. We don't think of ourselves as political. And in fact, we are taught to be apolitical. We are taught that we should not carry with us into our classroom our political beliefs, also supposedly our religious belief and all these other social beliefs that we may have, because that classroom in the school is supposed to be apolitical, neutral ground. So you leave those values, those morals in the parking lot at the front door, so that when you come in, you don't bring your personal values and beliefs, and you don't let those personal values and beliefs come into your classroom. You're to maintain this neutrality. Now, think about this, teachers, and the same goes for parents as well, but think about this, teachers. Am I right when I'm giving what I just said? That our training, I don't care what level that you're training to teach, elementary, middle school, high school, and to some extent, to a lesser extent, but to some extent, even college, university. We are trained not to be political in our profession as a teacher. I know for myself, I didn't train, as I've said many, many times, I didn't train to be a classroom teacher, a pre-K to 12. I was always training to go to university. But I remember distinctly when I started teaching, I would say that I'm not, to my classes, that I'm not bringing in my personal values and beliefs and my religious, well, I didn't have religious, and all of those things, because I didn't believe I should, as a professor, that I should be value neutral in that regard, and that I owed it to my students to, as a professional, to not seek to influence or indoctrinate them along my political, social views. I would have that conversation every class at the beginning of each quarter or each semester that I was teaching. And I just thought about this just a few minutes ago before we came on air, that I bought into that. But here's what happens for almost all of us. Okay. When we decide to go into teaching, and we, depending on what state you're in, whether or not you can major in education so that you can become a teacher starting your junior, senior year, or if you can't major in education, like California, there's no major in education as an undergraduate. You take whatever area that you want to study in, and then once you graduate, you go into what is called a fifth year. That's a credential year. And it's the equivalent of a master's, because you have to do 30 semester units of study. Once you complete it, you get, quote, your credential, and in a particular, either for middle school, high school, and a subject matter area. That's our training. In that training, I'll bet each and every one of you, most likely, you were instructed or encouraged not to bring your political and some, in most cases, I'm going to say most cases because this is probably very hard, your religious, cultural beliefs in your class. But in telling us that, what they were saying was, don't bring your personal. Instead, you teach the cultural, you teach the political, you teach the values, principles of the dominant ruling class in Western Europe, their history, or history as they wanted to be taught, their economics courses want to be taught, the art, the music, whatever. Not your personal views on any of these, or in any of these areas, but the accepted, standardized version. That's political, people. Bring this up because our training is political. That training is also a socialization process. We're being socialized to not bring our personal views on politics, social issues, contemporary historical, not to do that, but instead to teach the political, social, historical, da-da-da-da-da-da of the ruling class, the elite. So you are being socialized to not do one thing, but socialized to do another thing. Most of us, I'm sure, when we were in school, never saw it that way. But that is reality of all of this. Now, let me burst your bubble. You may hang up or whatever. You and myself, but not so much as it pertains to me, because again, I was at the university level. I was not a classroom teacher. To burst your bubble, folks, you are not a professional. You run around saying, you know, professional teacher versus, say, Teach for America and professionally trained versus having come out of Relay or Broad Academy or Bloomingburg Principal, whatever, you name it. We are professional. We're not. At the pre-K to 12, we're not. I'm going to let that linger for a moment. I don't know how many people are cussing me out, but we're not. Here's why we're not. To be a professional, you are to have autonomy. You have autonomy in your practice of your profession. Of course, within maybe legal limits or what have you, but you are the professional. If you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you are a university professor, you were not only an expert, you were a professional. Professionals don't join unions, they join associations. Professionals have recognizable and appreciated expertise that separates them from the others. In this scenario, at best, you are semi-professional. You don't have autonomy, and I think everyone would agree with me on that point. Everything is prescribed, federal, state, district, even at the principal level. How many of you have been complaining in the last 10 years about scripted curriculum, that everything is scripted? It's taken away your creativity, taken away your basically autonomy to be able to come in and teach the way that you know would be the best for your students. But you can't do that, because on Tuesday at 11:10, you're supposed to be here in today's lesson. And by 11:30, you're supposed to be here. And if you're not, you're in trouble. As a professional, and a recognized and appreciated professional, that wouldn't be the case. I'll give you a comparison. I started teaching at one of the best universities in the world. Like all the other colleges and universities, I created my syllabus. I selected the book that I was going to, or books that I was going to use. I planned out what you maybe would call lesson plan in terms of this week. I was teaching twice a week. We're going to talk about A and B this week and then C and D next week. I did all of that. I didn't have to turn it in to the department chair or anyone else for approval. I taught the way that I wanted to teach. I created my own tests. I graded my tests. I gave essay tests most of the time in the beginning of my career. And I graded them. I met with students who didn't agree with my grading. I didn't have to worry about said students going to the department chair or the dean to complain about my grade, because the department chair or any of my colleagues would never step one foot into my classroom to observe, to have anything. If they wanted to come because I was going to lecture on something, they would ask me. That was one of the biggest no-nos in our profession. Why? I was an expert. And I could teach as an expert the way I wanted to teach, what I wanted to teach, and the whole nine yards. Contrast that with being a pre-K to 12 teacher. You don't have that autonomy. And even today now, it's even worse. If you had any autonomy 10, 15 years ago, 30 years ago, it's damn near gone now. So, and another example. Remember that old saying, those who can do, those who can't teach? Yeah. Or how about this? If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. We don't look like professionals, supposedly. We're not perceived as professionals. We're not treated as professionals. We don't get a chance to act as professionals. Hence, we're not professionals. We're at best semi-professionals. What does all of this mean so far? I'm trying to lay the foundation here and saying that because of our training and graduate, undergraduate teacher prep program, we are trained not to really be professionals, and we are trained not to be activists, not to be critical of the status quo. Even though the status quo may change from day to day, week to week, month to month, not to be critical. We are trained to be obedient servants. And the more you are, most likely, to a considerable extent, the more you're going to be rewarded as a team player. And what I just said not only applies to teachers, but it applies to your administrators, your principals. If I do know something about the K to 12 environment, I worked in it as a sub for a while, and then I worked in it as a classroom teacher for 1 year. And most of my friends, I married a teacher. Most of my friends were teachers, or her friends were teachers. I went to public school, so I do have this long history in association with our schools And so I think I have a pretty good grasp of the things that I'm saying here. But take your principal. You don't become a principal being a maverick. You don't keep your job as a principal being a maverick. You keep your job by being able to demonstrate that you can work within the framework established by the district and or the state and to some extent the federal government. You can keep the troops in line, being your teachers, and you know this to be a fact. The principals, they don't want any controversy in the classroom or in their school. They want to shove it under the rug if something happens. They want to turn off the light so it's not in the light of day. Now the pressure of high tests, high stakes testing, they want to be able to show that they can produce high scores. They do what they can do to get their teachers to buy into the high stakes testing regime, even to the point where cheating and You know this. All I'm saying here is that that's part of, quote, our training. That's part of, quote, our professionalization, which is another word for our socialization in a graduate school. I keep saying graduate school because in California, you go to graduate school to get your credential. And so you come into a district. The district has its norms, its rules, its culture. And you want and have to show that you are a good soldier. You're going to follow the rules. You're going to do everything that you can to excel within the construct of the rules, the expectation, the culture of the district. Your fellow teachers, and they have gone through the same process that you are going through. This training in college, undergraduate, this training when you go through your practice teaching, training when you go into your first job and the master teacher supervises you, and even before all of this, depending on where you grew up, your family values, views, the community that you went to, the community that you lived in, and of course now, social media, they all play a role, various degrees, in your socialization and, quote, your professionalization as an educator. Take everything that I said, 9 times out of 10, 9.5 times out of 10, none of that socialization prepared you to be an activist in opposition to whatever the status quo is. I'm willing to bet almost everyone that, and I said this, and I remember, I think it was the first year that we were on air, and I had a guest on, another educator, university professor, and we were talking about something like what we're talking about now. And my position in as it is today was that we're not trained to be critical of the status quo. Flat out, we may be trained in controversies of Dewey versus some other educational philosopher, progressive education versus some other form of education. If you take a philosophy or a history of education, I don't think, well, this has changed since I was both a student and a teacher, that you got into political education unless you were a social science major and you studied political science and to some degree sociology education, you wouldn't get political education studies. And so that everything that you experience works against you becoming an activist, an educator, activist, educator. And that stance, if you have your own moral compass, and now you're the teacher across the hall next door is a play by the rules as the rules are set down by the private interests, be it political, economic, that is prevailing, you know there's always going to be first that nudge to bring you and your views back in line, maybe be a gentle nudge. If not, you don't conform, then that nudge may get a little more aggressive to the point where ostracism, it may from individuals to a group, you're a liberal in a conservative profession and a conservative enterprise, you then can't, if you're going to survive in that environment, you can't openly display your critical perspective. You certainly can't change it and say, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it this way because this way is best for my students. The other way is detrimental. My moral compass won't permit me to do it that way. Think about, was it about 3 years ago when there were teachers here, there, maybe over there, started saying that they couldn't administer the standardized test to kindergartners, first graders, and what have you. And they declared themselves conscientious objectors. You guys remember that? There was one teacher in New York City. She was on the show several times. I ended up meeting her when I was in New York in 2015. There was a teacher in Florida, a teacher in Ohio, and a few others that were on the show, and we were talking about this conscientious objector. And each time I was talking to the show, I would say, I believe it's more like the Hippocratic Oath. And the first principle of the Hippocratic Oath is, physician, do no harm. What you're saying is, you cannot, in good conscience, harm your students, knowing that giving these standardized tests or this curriculum is going to be very harmful. So hence, your conscience won't let you do it. Just like people who said they couldn't kill, shoot, da-da-da-da in the military, and the military recognized this status called conscientious objectors, you maybe wouldn't even be drafted, or you'd be let out of the military, or you would be put into, say, the medical corps or something of this nature, so that you would not violate your conscience. So we had that going, and we have today, I talked about this a month ago, when especially here in New York, the state of New York, there were teachers who were very interested in setting up freedom schools. And I talked to a group or two, and I said, if you do so, you must recognize that's a political act. And there may be consequences, political and economic consequences, so that you have to, in my view, you have to understand what, quote, freedom schools are all about, how they came about, how they were perceived then, how they're perceived now, and what type of pushback and where it may come from if you're going to do a freedom school. And if you're really sincere about doing this, you need to know all of these things. So that's the same thing. These are examples of what I'm saying in terms of this notion of the educator activist. Do we have educator activists? Do we have people who are underground educator activists? Because they cannot expose themselves as an educator activist. And by this I mean the activists who are against the neoliberal, what I call the Machiavellian agenda, and the war on public education, and any and all of the facets of this war. Sure, there are teachers who are activists, but on the other side. And they can be far more open with their antagonism because their position is more in line with the power structure. And as a result, they may be rewarded for their activism, whereas those on the other side may be punished. Let me kind of not quite switch horses, but let me take us in a different direction before we run out of time here. When I talked about last week and the week before that, when we were talking about the community schools, and I laid out the different community schools and their different purposes, and I raised the question of whether or not community schools was the last chance to save public schools. I don't know if you really heard me when I asked that question, and you got the unspoken, what I was speaking. That was profound, because, as you know, you're living it, and parents, we're losing the war on saving public education, public schools. And the community schools may be our last hope to save public schools. And across the country, community schools are popping up like wildfire, because I think they see it as maybe the last chance at saving public schools by changing the purpose. Remember, the last month was all about the purpose of education, public education, public schools. By changing their purpose, in a bold fashion, maybe then they'll be able to get the student engagement, teacher engagement, that will lead to a rising tide of scores and da-da-da-da, whatever the other measures are. Here is what I want you to think about. And I said teachers. The teachers that were we, and I say we, are going to need to be a part of this rise of community schools. And what I was saying was that, or actually raising a question and also making a statement, that teachers of today, teachers who have been teaching 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, what have you, having a hard time dealing with the new regime and its emphasis on Common Core curriculum, if you want to call almost all curriculums that now, and high-stakes testing and the austerity and all of those things. Teachers are suffering and leaving the profession and going on medication, you name it. My question was, what kind of teacher are we going to have now and going forward? I have a vision of that teacher, and I didn't want to lay it out then, and I'm only going to partially lay it out now. But I'll say this. How many of you are aware of the great, great push now on inquiry-based education? Inquiry-based. And to go along with inquiry-based, the project-based learning. I don't know if you have it in your school or you are doing it in your own classes now, but, and I've sort of mentioned this when I went back to Dewey and experiential education, and Dewey was saying that the best way to teach and to learn is through hands-on experience. Well, also the idea that we need to keep students engaged. And the reason, some of the reason, if not a large part of the reason why kids drop out of school or they do poorly academically or behaviorally and they're pushed out of school, or they don't come to school as truants, and on, is that we're not engaging them. And then they'll say the same thing about teachers. Teachers are not engaged any longer, and teachers need to become more engaged. And that, that's a whole other subject, and I'll talk about that later, about engagement. But the idea here is that inquiry, especially in the social sciences or social studies, the notion of inquiry is that you ask a question. You challenge your students. You know this. I'm assuming you know this. You challenge your students to get hands-on in finding an answer, as opposed to you telling them the answer, or you doing a lot of pushing in certain directions so that they can stumble upon the answer. And you, by going with the inquiry paradigm, you're getting the students engaged, and especially if you are getting them engaged in things that they are interested in, issues that they are interested in, things that impact their lives outside of the classroom outside of the school. And that if you can do that, you have a much better chance of getting your students to be engaged. And then you give them this project-based learning assignment where they now have to do research. And they now have to get involved hands-on. But it's something that is being involved in something that's very important to them. Like here in Buffalo, almost at Los Angeles in Buffalo, I went to a couple meetings last month where the students were presenting their voice on police violence here in Buffalo. And another one that I went to where the community, they were presenting their voices on gentrification and some other subjects here. These are things that people interest, so they come out for it. Students, they're interested, they'll get engaged. They'll get hands-on. And then if you structure it right, you hit critical thinking, you hit critical engagement, you hit critical learning, you also raise literacy, and you can get them to grow in terms of reading and writing literacy skills, and on and on and on. This, to me, this pivot to the inquiry base, the pivot to project learning, is a foretelling of what teachers now and going forward are going to have to be able to do. Back to myself, I have always been involved in inquiry, curiosity. I've always been in wanting to know things. And when I'm really engaged, I want to go all the way back to trying to find the first word was ever written on whatever it is I'm studying, and then come all the way up to where we are today. That's engagement. It does work. When I get engaged, I'm 24/7. You get students engaged 24/7. Boom. You get teachers engaged. Boom. You do this by do the inquiry method, followed by the project based learning. And then there's some other components that I don't have time that I think will also be manifesting themselves in terms of how schools, and particularly the community schools, if that become the standard, are going to do this engagement, and the teachers are going to have to either go back to school or on their own, but most likely going back to school to learn how to become experts at teaching from the engagement perspective, teaching project learning approach. Learning to be, in short, researchers/scholars. And that's where this whole show was based from. Becoming scholar activists, or what can be known as public intellectuals. We need to become public intellectual. We need to be able to engage with the public more. We need to be able to share our expertise with the public so that the public will see us as professionals. The public will listen to our voice. The public will be able to hear our voice and will be competing against the special interest voice. Right now, we don't have that voice before the public. We need said voice. We need that type of activism if we're going to save public education, public schools, and save our profession. We need to move from being perceived and treated as semi-professionals to professionals. Being able to become that researcher, become that intellectual, become that scholar that can get students engaged, get themselves engaged, develop a relationship with their community, develop a relationship with the larger public, get our voices heard. And I can tell you how that has been done and can be done. And I said, we're going to be dealing with basically social justice and how social justice encompassed all the things that I talked about today. Sorry, folks, my time is up, and I'm probably really feeling that I'm just getting started. So have a good rest of your Sunday, and let's come back together next week, and hopefully I'll do a better job if I didn't get my points over to you today, lay the foundation so that we can then grow from it over the next 3 weeks. Have a good rest of your Sunday, everyone. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.